If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
We need to shed our sort of conventional ideas of empire, which is empire as hegemony, where there is a dominant core that controls or dominates peripheral areas. And I would argue that the Holy Roman Empire, first of all, doesn't have a stable core, and it's also much more of a kind of overarching idealized order.
That was Peter Wilson discussing the Holy Roman Empire.
He was able to use a very simple palette of water, grass and trees, as we can see here, and turn it into something that looked almost natural.
And that was Sarah Rutherford at Blenheim Palace, talking about the work of Capability Brown. You're listening to the History Extra podcast from BBC History Magazine. We're the UK's best-selling history magazine, available from all good newsagents or via subscription. Check out our latest subscription deals at historyextra.com/subscribe. The magazine is also now available on many digital devices, including the iPad, iPhone, Kindle, Kindle Fire, Google Play, Kobo and Zinio. Look out for us in your app store or newsstand, or find out more at historyextra.com/digital. Welcome to our first podcast of March 2016. I'm Rob Attar, the editor of BBC History Magazine. Our first interview this week is with Peter Wilson, who is Chicheley Professor of the History of War at the University of Oxford. Peter's the author of a new book entitled The Holy Roman Empire, A Thousand Years of Europe's History, which tells the story of this unusual Central European entity from its formation at the time of Charlemagne to its eventual destruction by Napoleon in the early 19th century. Our digital editor, Emma Mason, met up with Peter in Oxford recently to find out more.
Your new book, The Holy Roman Empire, covers 1,000 years from 800 AD to 1806. How did you go about writing such an extensive history?
Oh, well, I thought right from the beginning that I wasn't going to do it in chronological order, because then it would just be one damn thing after another. So it was then a question of finding a kind of thematic structure that enabled me to convey what I wanted to say in terms of an argument, whilst also including elements of chronology within each of the themes so that readers can pick up the story and see where it heads in its various different directions.
How would you say we should define the Holy Roman Empire, and how does it compare to other medieval empires?
Well, that's a huge question that I could probably fill easily 45 minutes trying to answer. I think the first thing is that we need to shed our sort of conventional ideas of empire, which is empire as hegemony, where there is a core, a dominant core that controls or dominates peripheral areas. And I would argue that the Holy Roman Empire, first of all, it doesn't have a stable core, and it's also much more of a kind of overarching idealized order. Doesn't work perfectly all the time, but it nonetheless is different from how we would conceive of empire, given the legacy of European colonial imperialism and the way that we tend to conceive of empire today.
Mm-hmm. And what were the origins of the Holy Roman Empire?
Well, the actual origins come in a kind of typically sort of murky political fudge and deal between Pope Leo III, who's an very shifty character, and the Frankish strongman Charlemagne. Charlemagne wants legitimacy, wants to be recognised for his conquests, which are genuinely hegemonic conquests, whereas Pope Leo wants a protector. And the Byzantine emperor is too far away. And in the process of establishing this, they come up with what is essentially a fiction that the ancient Roman Empire has continued, that it's now defunct in Byzantium, and then they transfer it, they so-called translate it from east back to the west. So according to them and subsequent writers, the Holy Roman Empire is in fact a direct continuation of ancient Rome.
How integral would you say religion was to the Holy Roman Empire, and how did the empire handle conflict and disorder?
Well, again, two enormous questions. but I suppose, first of all, religion in the sense that the empire is an idealised Christian order, and one of the main parts of the imperial mission is to uphold that order, and that includes, where necessary, interfering with the papacy and questions of reform of the papacy. So there are conflicts then in the Middle Ages which are to do with the balance between secular and ecclesiastical jurisdictions, and then those conflicts become overlaid with then conflicts over the nature of religion itself, particularly given the Reformation in the 16th century. And the empire manages to overcome those after considerable effort and considerable conflict by essentially taking doctrine out of politics. So religion is treated really as a form of jurisdiction, as a form of rights that can be handled through a legal process, and disassociated from the actual doctrinal conflict, or rather doctrinal content that would be allied to the structures, the church structures.
And you mentioned conflict there. I noticed in the book you say that the Holy Roman Empire's relations with Italy, France and Poland dictated the course of countless wars. Could you tell us more about that?
Well, there are the wars that are fought within the area of the empire itself, especially during the Middle Ages, conflicts which are essentially between the emperor and the Pope or the papacy, various rivalries to do with that. And I think we should see those conflicts precisely as that, rather than as national wars. These are not wars between Italy and Germany. And likewise, the conflicts to the east, so various conflicts with Polish, Bohemian and Hungarian elites are, again, conflicts which we can't really impose a sort of later national interpretation on. These are conflicts over often very highly personalised conflicts, rather than conflicts which are over, say, national identities or constitutional issues as we would conceive of them in later years.
And how many conflicts, I mean, a ballpark figure, is that possible?
Well, then you have to see what you define as a conflict, and this is problematic. But I would say that the empire is certainly it has no worse a record than other states in terms of internal civil wars throughout the Middle Ages. There are only really three or four that have of any major substance after the kind of 9th century, where there is a whole cycle of quite vicious conflicts. In early modernity, during the 16th century, where France and the Netherlands are tearing themselves apart, the empire is largely quiet. There are only small localized conflicts. Then, of course, we have the 30 Years' War, which is a genuinely cataclysmic conflict. And then we have a renewed cycle of internal conflicts between Austria and Prussia in the 18th century, which arguably are also imperial civil wars. They're fought over dominance within the area of the empire. So these are major struggles, but then we are looking across a millennium.
Mm. Absolutely. And I noticed in the book you also say that the empire's history has been somewhat reduced to a repetitive and chaotic cycle lasting.
Yes.
Is that a continuation of Exactly.
I mean, the big problems with trying to interpret the empire are trying to fit it into categories that are invented much later. And so the empire gets reduced to Germany's Middle Ages, largely because the Italians and the Czechs and the Poles couldn't really find much use of it for it when they were constructing their own national identities. So it's left to German historians who see it as, or saw it, I mean, because views have changed, of course, but who saw it really in terms of a failed nation state. So all the conflicts are then chalked up to supposed deficits in the inability to create a stable and strong national state, rather than actually looking at how contingent those conflicts were on much more immediate factors. They're not about grand visions about how the state should be constructed, but are rivalries, often highly personalised rivalries within a relatively small elite. And there are also conflicts which are not major struggles in the way that, say, the 30 Years' War was. The medieval conflicts are, they might be of some duration, but they are fought in an entirely different manner, not involving large numbers of people.
Okay, and in terms of the empire generally, how, again, like you said, such a huge, vast period of history, but how did the empire change over the course of its existence?
Okay, it changes, first of all, it becomes much more hierarchical. They insert ever more layers defined by status and rights, so that the emperor ends up only having an immediate relationship with the great bulk of the population. So in other words, the emperor didn't act on the inhabitants as his direct subjects. They are subjects of intervening layers of authority, and he acts then on those intervening layers. So this is one of the reasons why it looks so complicated, because people don't like these kind of complexities and are trying to sort of reduce it into something more simple. The other thing is that its political culture shifts from one based on personal presence, where it was much more important to meet amongst the elite. So the emperor travels around constantly. That's one of the reasons why there isn't a fixed capital. He's constantly travelling around, showing himself, and meeting individuals in often following discreet negotiations behind the scenes, and then they basically meet in some kind of assembly and formally enact a decision as if it was a kind of spontaneous moment. And this gradually shifts as writing becomes much more important. And then we shift to a culture that's based very much on written communication, the intention being to resolve conflict by fixing it, by making decisions precise. But of course, if you make things precise, then it also makes disagreements precise. And this is one of the problems. This is what I would say, that while I'm relatively more upbeat about the empire's history, I would also insert notes of caution, particularly by when we get to the 18th century, because the written culture had certainly made things much more rigid, and it was much more difficult to make major changes, because everyone was pointing to their own particular rights somewhere enshrined in some kind of written document.
I see. And you mentioned emperors there. Who would you say are the most remarkable Holy Roman emperors?
Oh, well, and when you have so many to choose from, there are certainly some good characters. Well, clearly, Charlemagne is fundamentally important, and all the others refer to him. So even the Habsburgs claim Charlemagne as one of their ancestors. Otto the First, otherwise known as Otto the Great, who is the one who is crowned in the middle of the 10th century and helps cement the empire as a kind of hierarchy of three major kingdoms, with Germany as the leading kingdom. Then we've got the sort of bad boys like Henry IV, who's picking fights with the papacy, and his sons rebel against him. Frederick the First, Frederick the Second, the two great Staufer emperors. We have kings who don't get the imperial title but nonetheless exercise imperial prerogatives, such as Richard of Cornwall, who is an English nobleman who becomes king of Germany. So some unexpected people like that. And then we have, yes, the sort of later on, the Habsburgs, so Charles V and One of my favourites is Ferdinand III, who's very, very pragmatic, and he's also very musical. There are just so many to choose from.
So many. and towards the end of its existence, how much control did the empire have over the kingdom within it?
It varied. I mean, the usual argument is that the empire is basically dissolved into a kind of loose confederation of sovereign states. And this is certainly not the case. There are obviously the largest being Austria and Prussia, both of which have, by the end of the 18th century, effectively their own empires outside the empire. But even Prussia adheres to the imperial political culture because it sees advantages in it. So the Prussian monarchs never have any desire to actually leave the empire, even when they're offered a title of Emperor of Northern Germany by Napoleon in 1804. They don't abandon the empire. And in many ways, Prussia is still technically within the old empire right up to 1806. It's not so much that the emperor or imperial institutions had sort of direct control, it's rather that the component elements see advantages in remaining within the system.
And you mentioned 1806 there, obviously a very important date. For those of our listeners who perhaps aren't overly familiar, how exactly did the empire dissolved? How do you explain its demise?
Right. Its demise comes through a combination of factors that are triggered by the French outbreak of the French Revolutionary Wars in 1792. And the empire is dragged unwillingly into a conflict because Austria and Prussia have decided to make a temporary alliance of convenience. And in order to legitimate this and their war effort against France, drag the empire into a war, and then Prussia pulls out in 1795 because it has trouble controlling its Polish subjects, and this essentially partitions the empire. The whole of the northern part of the empire is withdrawn from the war. The southern part goes under with the defeat of the Austrians against the French. And then when Austria has been defeated and the southern part of the empire effectively corralled into an alliance with Napoleon, then Napoleon settles his scores with Prussia and extends his network of satellite states across northern Germany as well. So it's in a number of phases. And the key things are the internal weakness, which is the fact that Austria and Prussia are now too large to be controlled by imperial institutions, and external pressure, the pressure from Napoleonic France.
Excellent. And in your book, you explore the negative interpretations of the Holy Roman Empire and how its history has been largely neglected. Why, first of all, could you tell us why you think those negative interpretations have developed and why it's been largely neglected? You mentioned earlier it's a very difficult history to sort of get your teeth into, get your head around, I suppose. Is that?
Yes, I think to be perfectly honest, it is just so complicated, and people don't like complexity, so they like to try to find sort of linear narratives that you can then fit all the events in. And the problem with the empire is if you construct that kind of narrative, it's based around emperors who are always doing the same thing and they all seem to end up in the same sort of failures. If we expect them to behave like monarchs did elsewhere. So we have that as one problem. The other one is that there is really no country other than Germany that has had any claim on the empire's history once it dissolved, because all the other countries, so for example Italy or Denmark or France or Poland, either became fully independent countries or the bits of the territory that once belonged to the empire then joined them, and so they're always seeing their own development in sort of some kind of antagonistic oppositional way to the empire. So there wasn't any real desire to claim the empire in any kind of positive sense.
I was really interested to read that the future US President James Madison drew upon the example of the empire to build his case for a strong federal union. the Continental Congress that would give his country its constitution in 1787. Could you tell us more about that?
Hamilton and Madison were arguing for a much stronger union following the experience of the American War of Independence. And what they wanted to do was to avoid a kind of loose union. And so they go through a whole series of historical examples. And the empire, of course, was still in existence at the time when they write. And like a lot of people looking at it from the outside, they couldn't really understand how it worked. And they see it, in fact, as a loose union, precisely the one that they don't want. And they point to all the kind of things that the empire seemed to lack. And a lot of writers in the later 18th and then in the 19th century, they describe the empire as a kind of deficit list. You know, there is no national capital, there is no standing army, there is no uniform system of taxation, and so forth. But by doing that, they're comparing the empire with just one form of political organization, a centralized national state. And the empire, in fact, had its sovereignty was fragmented, and rights and responsibilities were distributed along the hierarchy that I was referring to earlier. And so it organized a lot of these things collectively. And so if you don't see that, then you think they didn't exist. They just existed in very different forms.
What would you say is the Holy Roman Empire's legacy today, and why is it so important that we better understand it?
I think its legacy, on the one hand, is maybe not so obvious, and part of the point of the book is actually to sort of shed light on that and to actually show that it is important. The second thing is, I think it gets us to look and to consider European history in a different way. So not imposing frameworks that are based on the frontiers of present-day European states on the past. So, for example, discussing northwestern Europe in terms of Belgium, the Netherlands and Luxembourg actually makes very little sense. These frontiers are all very, very recent origin. Even Germany is a sort of movable feast. Italy is doesn't seem to exist and then does exist. And so I think if we sort of try to avoid back-projecting much later perspectives on the past, then the past can speak to us in different ways.
That was Professor Peter Wilson. The Holy Roman Empire, A Thousand Years of Europe's History, is out now in the UK, published by Alan Lane. And in the US, the book is due to be published in April by Belknap Press, with the altered title of Heart of Europe, A History of the Holy Roman Empire. Before our next interview, I'd like to mention that the March edition of BBC History magazine is now on sale. Inside this month's issue, there are articles on the Easter Rising, the dark side of Elizabethan England, sex under Henry VIII, and history's most delicious dishes, among other things. You can get hold of our March edition now, in all good newsagents in the UK, and our many digital formats. Print editions outside the UK may take a little longer to arrive in the shops.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Each month in the magazine, we include an article where we visit a site of historical importance accompanied by an expert in that field. For our latest issue, we turned our attention to Lancelot Capability Brown, the renowned Georgian landscape designer who was born 300 years ago. One of Brown's greatest achievements was the grounds of Blenheim Palace in Oxfordshire. So that's where we dispatched our journalist, Nige Tassel, in the company of garden historian, Dr. Sarah Rutherford. So let's hear how they got on.
It's a cold winter's day here at Blenheim Palace, but the view is magnificent out of the window of the room that we're in. We're looking across at the Capability Brown designed grounds of Blenheim Palace. I say we because I'm in the company of Sarah Rutherford, garden historian and author, whose new book, Capability Brown and His Landscape Gardens, is just about to be published. Hello, Sarah.
Hello, Nige.
Tell me a bit about Brown to start off with. Who was he? Where did he come from? Because we're in these fine surroundings here, but he wasn't a man from... He didn't come from the upper echelons of society, did he?
No, this wasn't his natural place to be, but he came from a very small village in Northumberland, and that was called Kirkhall, where he wasn't from what you might call the humblest class. His family were yeomans, and his brothers went on to marry ladies of quite good breeding and become estate managers. So he came from a family that was bettering itself, and he went to a local school and was taken up by the local landowner, who gave him the opportunity to learn his craft of gardening and possibly landscaping as well. His origins are quite obscure in some ways. We don't really know what he did in his earliest years. He was born in 1716 and he worked at Kirkhall in the late 1720s, early 1730s. So he didn't have a university education or anything like that, but he had a multitude of talents that gradually blossomed, and he made the most of them. So he moved out of Northumberland in the late 1730s and didn't leave his family entirely behind, but he moved south and stayed there pretty much for good.
Where do you think this drive and ambition came from then? If he's found this new area to work in.
I don't know what drove him exactly, but he was in a time which was a maelstrom of change, of exciting things happening, of opportunity. The Georgian period for him, he was in the best place at the right time to take advantage of it, and that he did. He had a genius for landscape design, the artistic side of things. He taught himself architecture. He understood engineering gradually learnt his trade. And he was also an able businessman and got on well with his clients, the aristocrats, the king, the wealthiest in the land.
He built such an amazing client list, as you say, from royalties down through prime ministers, cabinet ministers, lords. He obviously was a man who did a good job and did it with good grace in order to kind of retain those and develop this word-of-mouth reputation.
Absolutely. He was the man that he worked for the king, six prime ministers and half the House of Lords, and most of the wealthiest men in Britain. And they were desperate to get hold of him. It was extraordinary. They would write him letters saying, oh, please come and see me, Mr. Brown. I know that you've been unwell and haven't been able to come, but next time you're passing, I would very much value your opinion. Come and have a look at my grounds and see what you can do with them. So to have these men of power and wealth saying that to him, I think shows that he was very highly regarded.
And he was highly regarded at a young age as well, because it was 25, was it, when he became head gardener at Stowe?
He went to Stowe in 1741, so that was, 1716. But, yeah, about 25, 26, something like that. So, yes, he was very young. He started off as head gardener, but then Lord Cobham, who gave him various landscaping projects to do, he was also building lots of temples and garden buildings at the same time. Unfortunately, the clerk of works disappeared in rather unfortunate circumstances, and Brown was given that job of clerk of works. So that's when he taught himself a bit about architecture, and he was able to run contracts for Lord Cobham, so he understood how to manage staff and men doing jobs and all this sort of thing. So he was given, it wasn't exactly his apprenticeship, because he had done that sort of stuff, but it was the making of him with Lord Cobham, who could see his talents and made the most of them.
And then when he left Cobham, he essentially went freelance, you know, and became fated, as you say, by all and sundry. What was it about his work in particular that people seem to like? I mean, we're looking out the window here today at Blenheim, I mean, what in particular would maybe other lords who'd come here and see and be jealous of and want to replicate at theirs?
Every site has its own peculiarities. It's what somebody called the genius of the place. And Brown could see the capabilities of the genius of the place. In today's terms, we'd probably call him Potential Brown, because potential is the word we'd use. But he saw the capabilities and how to make an artistic picture out of them. He was an artist, and you can think of him as a bit like Rembrandt or Picasso or Turner. And people like Turner were representing his work in their own works of art. They could see he was making works of art themselves. But he was able to use a very simple palette of water, grass and trees, as we can see here, and turn it into something that looked almost natural. That was the key to it. It looked as though it was natural. And we look at it today and think, oh yes, that vast lake at Blenheim, that 40 acres, that's got to be natural. But actually, it comes from the weedy trickle of the River Glyme, which is very unpromising. And he worked out how to flood a valley, dam it, and keep that water there so that it didn't stagnate, it didn't turn into a muddy pond. And he could use it as the sort of high point of the whole landscape.
His style seems to be very much on a widescreen scale. It's all about scale and largeness, for want of a better word, rather than intricacy. Would that be a fair comment?
It's large scale made up of intricacy. So it's both. He was good at the detail. He had to understand the detail for the engineering to make the water features and create buildings. He also understood how to site trees and shrubberies to make the most of views, to screen things you didn't want to see, so that he might use a single tree to divide a view so that you looked either side of it and saw particular framed views. But that was detail. He understood where to put that tree so that you got the maximum effect out of it. And one of his favourite trees was the cedar of Lebanon, with those flat, it's a conifer with those flattened branches so that it looks like layers. And another one was a London plane. He'd put one of those or two next to a bridge because its pale colour would highlight that there was a feature there that people wanted to see.
What about his competitors? What put him ahead of them?
At Stowe, Lord Cobham introduced him to lots of his friends. So he got a head start there, and he went and worked for them even while he was at Stowe. When Lord Cobham died, Brown went out on his own as what we would call a consultant today, a landscape designer and landscaper. And from then on, he never needed to advertise. Everyone beat a path to his door. And it's quite extraordinary. His competitors never had that kind of success. One of the nearest competitors, he worked on about 250 or more sites. One of his nearest competitors, William Eames, worked on about 90 or so sites. But Brown was the one that they all wanted. He got the name because of his genius, I think, although it is difficult to tell one landscaper's work from another just by looking at it. They used quite similar features. But Brown had the prestige. You know, that's why they wanted him. He got the name. The others were all rather more regional. He was countrywide. He was crisscrossing the country on his horse the whole time. A few sites in Wales, mainly in England. And he got asthma, presumably from the horse, you know, the dust of the horse. And he had to be laid up from time to time. But on the whole, he was all over the place, like many consultants today. You know, he just went where the work was.
Would he have had his imitators? Would people have borrowed his style and tried to undercut him in order to get the work?
Oh, yes. His competitors usually charged less than he did. So, and also, sometimes it took him a long time to get to a place, and because he was in demand, he sometimes didn't turn up very often. So usually the more regional competitors were on the spot, and they'd be there for their client whenever they wanted them because they were much more able to do that. So, yes, they did also use the same palette as him. Some of them had worked for him and then went out on their own, which he didn't mind in the slightest. And really, I don't think he cared. There was enough scope, there were enough parks being made that he worked for the highest in the land, and there was plenty left that he didn't touch that the others could hoover up the crumbs off his table, if you like.
How many jobs would he have going at one any one time, and therefore how hands-on would he be with each one?
He was the face of the business. He might have a number of jobs at different stages. I can't tell you exactly how many, but, for example, he could go out on a preliminary visit, meet Lord so-and-so, go round I say site because sometimes they were parks already. Other times they were agricultural land, so they weren't at all landscaped. So they'd go round the gentleman's estate, have a look at it. He'd give the gentleman some ideas. Then he'd go away and get one of his men from his office to come out again and survey the site, because you've got to know what is there before you can start with a design. Then they'd do a design as well. So for about 100 guineas, you could get a visit or two from Brown, a survey from his man of the several hundred acres they were looking at, and a fair drawing as well of a design for the client to have. At that point, the client decided whether he wanted his own men to carry it out, put it on the ground, or Brown sometimes did that, especially on bigger jobs. I think at Blenheim he managed the staff himself. Annick, he was working with his own teams alongside the actual estate staff as well, the bailiff. So there were two lots of teams, very peculiar, that one. Must have been a lot of friction there. So there were different levels that you could, levels of work. So he might have a number of jobs on at any one time. I think the 1760s is thought to have been his busiest, and he was turning over tens of thousands of pounds. And in today's terms, you're looking at millions and millions and millions. But if he was paid £30,000 for a job, or 20-something thousand as he was at Blenheim, that wasn't all his profit. That was to pay the staff and to get the job done. So he took a sum for himself. And he had to pay for his office staff and keep himself going.
How many people would he have under his command then, or as his regular staff?
Well, he had two men that we know of in the office who were surveyors and also drew up survey plans and fair drawings. He had a number of foremen. As I've said, some of them went out and worked on their own eventually after they'd learnt their craft with him, and he didn't mind that, it seems. So he overall had, I think, 20 or 30 foremen that he used. But then one, like Mellicant, worked only at Chatsworth and then went down and Brown handpicked him to work for the king at Kew, at the landscaping of Kew, and then after that he carried on maintaining it. So the foreman didn't work on every single job. They were specific to particular places.
The landowners, was there competition between themselves to have the best grounds? Would they see one particular house's grounds and want to better that and therefore push Brown to new heights?
It was definitely one-upmanship if they could afford it. Clearly here at Blenheim, the Marlboroughs could afford it. Going back to what I said earlier, if you could only afford a plan for 100 guineas, then you took that and got your own people to do as much of it as you could. Sometimes his plans weren't carried out, sometimes only partially. There's a site in Hatfield Forest in Essex where part of it was carried out, but he wanted to serpentine the dam and make it wiggly of the lake that was already there. That was going to be very expensive, so they didn't bother to do that. So...
Did he tend to design to order? Was there any? Would he incorporate the ideas of the landowner in his own designs, or was he largely given free rein to impose what he wanted to impose?
Both. It depended on the landowner, of course. Some of them said, do as you want, just give me a landscape that my peers will be impressed with. I've got the money, you've got the taste, get on with it. Others said, no, we want you to do a specific thing. Jemima Gray at Rest Park Rest Park has a very straight canal with a big building at the end of it and formal alleys of grassy walks and that sort of thing. She wanted that kept because it reminded her grandfather, who she was very fond of, I think. So Brown's job was to tinker around the edges. So he did a bit of work to the drainage, he softened the edges of this formal landscape, and she put up a memorial to him, or no, a monument, sorry, not a memorial, because he was still alive, and was very pleased with what he did, but he wasn't allowed his own free rein by any means.
But he'd be happy to do that within...
Well, like any consultant, if you pay us to do something, you know, we'll do whatever you want us to do.
Yeah. Was there an international impact to his work? Was he in demand elsewhere at all?
Yes, he was in demand, but he never went. He was asked to go to Ireland, but he said no, he couldn't go over there, but he provided a stable block design for somebody, and he never went to Scotland. He provided a design for somewhere in France and maybe one or two places in Germany, but he didn't travel abroad. But his impact was that the Continentals, the burgeoning colony of America, people came over here and saw what he'd done. Thomas Jefferson at Monticello went back to America and used Brown's ideas in his own garden in Virginia. The Jardin Anglais in Europe was a great phenomenon, and Catherine the Great created that style of garden for her own palaces. So she was a great Anglophile, and that's what she did.
He had that particular style. What would be his signature touches?
Well, it's quite hard to say. He and his competitors and associates used quite similar styles and features. One of the things I've found a lot in researching the book is that he puts an island at the end of a lake or a river. And the idea of that is to make you think that the water goes on forever. You can't see where the water goes, so he puts a full stop around which the water runs, and that way you can't tell that it's not going on for another 100 miles. When we see what we call his lakes, sheets of water, they were actually meant to represent rivers. So even this huge lake that we're looking at Blenheim, it was meant to represent a vast river. It was called the Great River as well, and that was the idea. So it represented the River Arno in Florence or the River Tiber in Rome to evoke that classical Roman Augustan age. So you shouldn't think of it as a lake, you should think of it as a river, really.
In the book, you rank him alongside other Great Britons like Thomas Telford and Isabel Kingdom Brunel for his impact on the landscape at this time. Can you expand on that?
He was one of a number of geniuses in the mid-18th century. You've got Telford, who was doing the roads, that great road that goes out to Anglesey a little later on in the 18th century. Brindley, who was doing canals, he was very innovative himself, and they worked together on one or two schemes, including Alnwick. So it was a time of great opportunity for people. If you had the talent, if you had the technical skills, the business skills, and understood how to promote yourself, you could go an awful long way. People like Wedgwood were making a big impact and at the forefront of the Industrial Revolution. Brown wasn't quite like that. His staff were more artisans, like the furniture maker Chippendales. And so they were part of this great movement, but people were going in different directions.
You say it was a time that was ripe for him. Could he have been born, if he was born at another time, would he have had anything like the impact he had?
Possibly not, because he was a recipient of happenstance. I was going to say victim of happenstance, but that's not... No, he was one of the people who grasped it and made the most of it. So all these things came together at once. He went to Lord Cobham when Stowe was the greatest garden in Britain and was being looked at by the rest of the world, the Western world anyway, and got his reputation going there. He was loaned out to Cobham's influential friends. He was taken up by Lord Coventry at Croom after Lord Cobham died. Lord Coventry had his own friends and relations, and so it went on like that. And Brown also was, he soaked up knowledge like a sponge. He taught himself about architecture. He'd done his training in landscaping and gardening, but he must have had the talent to run a business, to get on well with those aristocrats and gentlemen. He was never one of them, but there's a lovely story about him drinking a bottle of Tokai with Lord Bute of Luton Hoo, you know, and Tokai was a very rare wine. I mean, you wouldn't normally give it to your staff. And there's a lovely story about when he met another great patron of his was Pitt the Elder. And there was a chance meeting between Pitt the Elder and Brown at an inn one evening at Staines, where they both stopped for dinner. Fortuitous. And as they parted, Pitt said to Capability Brown, "Go you and adorn England," to which Brown responded, "Go you and preserve it," which is rather fun. So he took advantage of all those circumstances that came together. There was also something rather dry called the enclosure movement, which meant that land was being consolidated into single large parcels with enclosure acts, so that the landowners were able to get hold of large areas that could be laid out as parks. So that there were all sorts of different things going on at the same time.
To what degree do his landscapes attempt to be functional as well as beautiful to the eye? I'm thinking in terms of country pursuits that the landowners would like to do. You know, obviously they need areas to do their hunting and wooded areas. And to what degree would he incorporate that into his thinking?
They were functional from an agricultural point of view. If you look at the grass out here, it should be grazed by sheep or cattle, and also horses, because horses were being bred and used a lot more. So they needed land to produce hay and grazing. Then you have timber in the woodlands. Throwing a woodland belt around a park was an interesting activity, because it had lots of functions. You could screen out the landscape beyond that you might not want to see. You could raise pheasants in it, and pheasants like woodland edges, so long narrow belts provide a lot of woodland edge for their happiness, which you can then shoot. You've got the production of timber was a great thing. It was very patriotic to produce timber. And in the 18th century, there were prizes given for those who grew or planted good stands of timber. So that was something for the long term. But even so, I mean, the trees that we see here that are mature would have been little saplings when they went in, all the cedars of Lebanon, the beech, the others. And of course, we've lost the elms. Don't forget elms, because they were very important to Brown. And so there were a lot of different ways that you could use the landscape. It wasn't just pretty. It had an economic use as well.
Did he ever see any of his designs as he totally imagined it, when the trees had become mature? Or did he always see them as works in progress during his lifetime?
Trees grow quite quickly. And so if he went back to some of his sites after 30 years, which he well could have done, if he'd gone back to Stowe, to the Grecian Valley, he would have seen that maturing. And as we've seen since the great storm in 1987, where things have been replanted, where you replant a woodland on the top of a hill, the brow of a hill, it may not be mature, but it gives it a false perspective. It looks as though that hill is further away because the trees are smaller, and you in your mind's eye, you think they're mature. So actually, you started to get that view, even though they weren't mature trees. It's different with specimen trees, but in the woodland, that was quite easy to see.
We've got to talk about his nickname, because to anyone who doesn't know what Capability refers to, might think that it's almost an insulting nickname to give someone of such genius. But as you've explained, the capability part wasn't describing him, but more describing his can-do attitude.
He was able to size up a site and say to the client, this place has its capabilities, my lord, meaning I can see how I could create a landscape that will please you. It might cost you a lot of money. And people tried to get him to reduce the costs of things. And one of his clients, one of the rich ones, he said, well, why would I do that? You can afford it. Why do you want to penny pinch? It's, you know, you want the wow factor. When we came through the Hensington Gate today into Blenheim from Woodstock, you think you're coming into a yard, then you go through an archway, and then the lake and the bridge and the palace open up in front of you. So why would you penny pinch on that? But anyway, so he was looking at the capabilities of a place, and he could size them up very quickly.
But it's still great marketing as well to have a nickname that basically says, I can do this job for you, doesn't it? In one word, I am capable of doing that, and your land is capable, has potential to also be exactly what you want it to be.
Yes, that's really interesting, because he was the capable one himself. I mean, I call him a genius, but he was also capable. Artistic genius is one thing, but being able to handle all those different disciplines, the money, the staff, the clients, being able to get on with the clients, certainly it made him very capable.
And finally, of course, it's the 300th anniversary of Brown's birth this year, with lots of events planned. What is his enduring legacy to us today?
His legacy are those landscape parks, basically. He was the face of the landscape park. He didn't invent it, but he did most of them, the most number of them. And they naturally settle into the British landscape. They're so beautifully settled in that you can't tell what's nature and what's artificial, his artifice. And that was influential all over the place. So it was really people seeing his work and then trying to copy it for themselves.
Do you think he still gets due attention, or will this year amplify his legend and give him the due respect?
He fell into a big trough after he died in 1783, and people started saying, oh, his work was too bland, it was too smooth, it needed to be rougher, things needed to be rougher. And of course, trends move on. We don't always stick with the same, we never stick with the same styles. But his name rather vanished. And so this year is brilliant, because it means that we can publicise. Most of his parks still survive. They were very enduring. People didn't wipe them out. They still have them and love them. So,
I mean, what we can see out the window as well, he would completely recognise. If he came back today, he would pretty much say, that's as I meant it.
Yes. I showed you just now a drawing that he did that's in the book about how he was going to plant the island out here in the lake with the backdrop of a great grassy bank leading up to the town of Woodstock that was sticking up like a medieval town with a defensive town wall around it. And it's pretty much as he envisaged it. So, yes, he would recognise it without doubt.
That was Nige Tassel and Sarah Rutherford. You can read more from them in our March issue, which is out now. Sarah's book, Capability Brown and His Landscape Gardens, is due to be published by the National Trust in April. And Blenheim Palace is open for visitors every day of the year except for Christmas Day. There is more information at blenheimpalace.com, where you can also find details about the palace's Capability Brown themed events this year. Meanwhile, a Capability Brown festival is taking place in many locations around the UK this year to mark his tricentenary. For more information on that, head to capabilitybrown.org. And that is pretty much it for this week, but please do listen in next time, when we'll be talking about the Tudors' relationship with the Islamic world, among other things. Thanks for listening to this History Extra podcast, which was produced by Jack Fletcher. Do let us know what you think about this episode by emailing podcast@historyextra.com, and we might read out your messages in future episodes. Alternatively, why not keep in touch via Twitter or Facebook, where you'll find us at History Extra. For more great history content, don't forget to visit our website, historyextra.com, where you will find history quizzes, galleries, articles, and more. Plus, it's where you can download every single previous episode of this podcast.